Return to Northmoor. Meta Episode 2. Running time, 46 minutes. Welcome to Return to Northmoor Meta Episode 2. This is a continuation of our previous episode, a sit-down chat with Doyce Testerman, the nexus of indie story game information, regarding how to blend indie games and D&D. So we're going to pick the discussion up where we left last time, and I hope you enjoy it.
On the character focus side of things, there's some questions you can ask players when they're making up their characters, like how do you each know each other? Or here's some significant NPCs. Tie yourself into at least two other NPCs and at least two other people at the table. Not just how do you know them, but what's at stake in that relationship? You know, what's at risk? What could be at risk? So that's something that you can just ask in terms of that. And then you can always go back and add another question. Give me a kicker. Somebody else in another game called Conspiracy of Shadows calls it the trigger. What is it that put you in motion? What is this thing that happened right at the beginning of the game that was so wacky or crazy or amazing that there's no way you could just go back? Let's say you start play right from there. Your next thing that you say to the GM says, well, I'm going to close the door and go back to sleep. There's no possible way you can do that. And that's what a kicker is. An example from one of my games, one of the guys he wakes up in the morning and he takes a shower and he walks into his walk-in closet with his little bathrobe and he pulls open the door and his girlfriend's hanging there on a meat hook. And there's a knock on the door and somebody says, police. Your example from Galactic, the very first thing that happened, your ship starts to go into a landing pattern for the planet and your ship does not have any landing gear. It's not actually atmosphere capable. When I ask you how your story starts and you gave me that, that's just a question. It's not a rules change. It's just a question of what you're asking your players. You can simply, with your authority as the GM, the DM, whatever, ask for input from the players. Plan for it. Know that there's a big question mark there in your story that's going to be filled in by the player.
And having structure around that, and I call it a Mad Libs type structure where I'm going to give you some blanks to fill in.
That's not a bad analogy.
I'm going to give you some blanks to fill in because this story would be very pedestrian if you didn't fill in the blanks.
Right.
Because you don't necessarily know what those blanks are going to be used for.
Right.
And that's where the really dynamic, interesting stuff starts to happen.
One of the fantastic things the Mountain Witch does, every character draws from a deck to get what their dark secret is going to be. If they don't like it, they can keep going until they get something that really grabs them. But they are the only one that knows that dark secret at the beginning. It falls to them to narrate it when the GM comes to them and says, what do you see and why do you see it? Or asks, is there anything that any of the NPCs says or does right now that would foreshadow your dark secret? And you have to contribute that because when I say that nobody else knows what your dark secret, I include the GM.
Yeah.
They don't know what it is. So if you don't tell, no one's ever going to know. And that's going to make the game kind of suck. So that adds some pressure to that, but you don't need that pressure if you're just playing a straightforward D&D game. You can start asking them to bring some stuff to the table. And usually one question, I don't care how low energy somebody is, people can come up with something that grabs.
You have to know your players. I mean, not to quote the Sons of Cryos guys so much and say talk to
your
players.
Know your players, you got to talk. Yeah.
Some players might respond well to that if put on the spot. Tell me right now what this is going to be.
Right.
Other people, maybe before the game, so they have some time to think about it.
You know what you do?
Better.
Open up the door and somebody's standing there. And it's a shock. It's an incredible, frightening shock. Who is it and why is it a shock to you? And now we're going to cut over to Joe over here. And we're going to play with him. And we'll come back to you and get that answer.
Oh, so even doing it at the table, you can still give them some time.
Yeah, you do a cutaway.
You want to push their comfort boundaries a little, but you don't want to make it so that they are just like, well, I don't want to play this game.
Nobody,
if you're going to put me on the spot.
Nobody does anything creative when they're asleep or when they're just,
You have to look at your group and manage the kibitzing on that to some degree. Because some players, they're not so good at coming up with answers about their character, but boy, they'll go on and on and on about what other people's
stuff
should
be. And there's a control factor there. We've had that conversation. My group in Denver does a lot of kibitzing. My wife just moved up from New York. She plays with a different group. They don't do a lot of that inter-character kibitzing. A lot of people chiming in, oh yeah, you should do this, or oh yeah, tell them I'm your father. They don't do that. We're trying to find a happy medium. One guy is going to turn to the table and say, guys, I got nothing. Anybody got something awesome? Somebody else, the guy will turn to you and say, hey, you know what you could do? And he'll be like, you know what? Shut up. I've got an idea. I'm good. Thanks.
Give me just a second. I'm working on something here. Just like it's frustrating when you're in a D&D game and you're sitting there scratching your head. Okay, well, should I use the magic missile or the scorching burst? Magic missile or scorching burst?
It doesn't help for somebody to come in and go, you know, you could cast sleep. That doesn't help.
Yeah. Just like that's frustrating sometimes. It's also frustrating when you're like, well, you know, should he be my father or maybe just our naughty uncle? And everybody else has thrown out a million ideas. Sometimes that's not helpful.
Oh, he could be your father and mine. Naughty uncle at the same time.
Sometimes that's cool,
or cousins,
and sometimes
whatever that
would make
us. The difference today versus say 10 years ago is you get somebody who's frustrated and you don't really know how to broach that. I will sit back and look at them and say, you know, I feel like this is really kind of ticking you off. Do you need input? Do you want less input? Do I need to change my shirt? What, you know, I don't care, whatever.
One of the things that I have is what I call the worksheet mechanic and the Mad Libs mechanic, where I say, all right, here's a worksheet. I like to do it in worksheets because it gives people structure and they can work on it as a team better.
Sure.
And the worksheet says, you need to fill in what your relationship is with this guy. And you need to fill in what your relationship is with this guy, what your relationships are with each other. You need to fill in five secrets. And the whole Northmore thing sort of kicks off with a worksheet that says, fill out all this stuff.
Right.
And that really lets all the players contribute and get that worked out in a format that really is very non-threatening, because all you're doing is filling in blanks on a sheet. You don't have to come up with a novel. You don't have to come up with really massive amounts of information.
It also keeps people from coming up with
a novel.
Because you've got people who will do that. They have elephantitis of the vocabulary or diarrhea of the mouth.
Right. So in addition to sort of generic techniques that you can use anytime, you can take a step back and do something a little more thorough and say, I'm going to elicit all this information from you in a very methodical sort of way.
We talked a little bit before about this is bartender. I need three facts about him, and dumping that on people and maybe having it come across as like, we must have broke the thing because we went into a bar that he didn't have anything on the bartender. Here's a fun trick. I want you and you and you, and point to three specific people on the table. Each one of you come up with a fact about this bartender. It's significant. There's a reason that I am doing this. I want you three people specifically to each come up with one fact about this guy. I'm telling you this because this guy has a connection to you three guys. Maybe you made that up just then. But I tell you what, it will be one of those pivotal moments in the game where it's like, wow, this guy is like, he's the key. He's why those three guys are connected. They don't even know they're connected. It's like a moment on Lost where it's like, dun, dun, dun. And it's a guy that you made up like, I actually don't have anybody here for this NPC. Okay, you three, and there's meaning to it.
And I think that could really help make up for something that happens a lot when you're the GM, which is you lose connection with what the players think is important about the story. You've got your stuff in mind.
Because I would have forgotten.
And other players are like, well, actually, what my character cares about is XYZ, and you totally have ignored that. But as soon as you ask them, well, what does your character think of this guy? Suddenly that stuff comes to fore, and wow, you're blown away.
One of the best things about getting player input about any of this stuff is you do all this really amazing stuff, whatever it happens to be. You're doing up a big plot kind of thing, and you think it's going to be awesome, and you get there, and it just kind of falls flat.
Right.
If you're going to the players and soliciting their input on, you know, what's the history behind this orphan that you just found or whatever, and they're giving you this information back, it's almost guaranteed that that's going to be stuff that they're interested in. You don't have to guess, is this going to be something that they're into? Because they wouldn't be
telling you.
Be telling you if it wasn't something that was in their head as something that, well, this would be kind of cool.
So,
and if it would be kind of cool, then yeah, use it. Why not?
One of the things that I've noticed in terms of player narrative control is that you end up with a lot of meta talk at the table. It's like, okay, here's the scene, what's framing it, and there's all this kind of meta discussion.
Right.
And then your actual narrative maybe just like 2 minutes of that, but you had a like 10-minute discussion ahead of time about what it's going to be.
You know, that's always a danger. I'm not sure that I'm necessarily 100% all the time awesome at that. It helps to have that focus. It helps to have that almost Mad Libs thing and say, I want player input here, but we're going to keep it in a box on this blank line. I want this detail filled in. That keeps it from being too meta. One of the things that's nice about the fact that a lot of people grew up playing D&D is they're used to the idea of a GM. They're the greatest amongst equals. And that's okay because of all the culture behind that. So sometimes you have to kind of cheat a little bit and say, you know what, I'm going to say this, this, and this about it without asking for input. And unless I do a bad job of that, it's probably not going to feel too weird.
There's a great rule in Galactic, actually, that says it's okay for someone to say, this happens, and this happens. But at any time, because this is your scene, you can disagree.
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier, I think, for players to say, no, I'm going to stop you there and we're going to go back a little.
Absolutely.
Than it is for them to sort of invent that stuff from whole cloth.
Right, absolutely. So it's great. I mean, it's great to have people kick in. There's a fine point at that where you've talked enough mating and say, okay, guys, we're going to take this right to the game. Let's play. I like what I'm hearing, but let's play. You want to narrate the lamp with the human skin and for the lampshade? Great, do that, but we're going to do it in the game. We've made a talk this enough. Don't play before you play, you know?
So let's talk for a minute about how D&D does or does not deal with failure.
Combat's really difficult with D&D dealing with failure, because failure usually means you're dead.
Right.
Or you're unconscious. There isn't a good mechanic. And just to contrast that with a lot of indie games, they tend to use the same mechanic for both for any conflict of any kind,
right.
They're using kind of the same mechanic. It doesn't make sense for you to die from a diplomacy check. So they had to figure out different ways. Okay, I've won this. Now I get to say how this is going.
Right. Or Burning Wheel says, okay, well, we got to this point, so now you have to compromise.
Exactly. And Burning Wheel, to a certain extent, you always have the ability to tap out. My life is a little bit too much at risk here. Dogs in the Vineyard is very good at that. Oh, guns came out. Well, you know what? He wants to win this argument. He can win that argument. I don't want to get shot.
I'm just going
to
give.
They've got escape mechanisms that D&D doesn't have in combat. Skills work a lot better for that. And failure in skills can be awesome. Done a certain way. I think everybody's probably run into a situation where they're at the long hallway with the locked door at the end and the thief steps up and
can't unlock the door.
He can't unlock the door. I mean, it's bad. He rolls a one and the GM has a roll again and he rolls another one.
Right.
You're stuck. The GM is stuck. You've got nothing that you can do at that point in time without completely backing out and coming back in from another direction. Obviously, that kind of sucks. The way of framing that so that you can come back at that problem again from a different situation is not to frame it in terms of do you get the door open or not. You frame the question in terms of do you get the door open before something interesting happens? Can
right.
you get the door open before the guards walk down the hallway?
Because the way that it really is framed in D&D is do you get the door open with the lockpicks or do you get the door open with the fighter bashing the door down?
Right.
Either way, you're going
to
get the door
open. The door has to open. But what you can do is have failure be awesome. I love the idea of coming up with a situation so interesting either way that the players
right.
are like, I almost hope I blow this roll. Can I convince the Duchess to go along with my plan before the Duke comes over and challenges me for a duel for me being too intimate with her?
Right.
You know, I would kind of like that to happen, man. The Duke comes over and challenges me. Do you know what that would do with my socialist? Okay, can I blow this roll? Can I actually just not roll and take a zero? Please?
I often will make analogies to the Indiana Jones movies, which are actually the most D&D movies that have ever been made.
Sure.
In Temple of Doom, they're walking down the hallway and someone leans against a switch, which accidentally kicks off the room.
Right.
Okay, he makes his perception check. He notices it is a switch, he doesn't press it. How is that more fun?
It's not more fun.
Yeah.
It seems so dead obvious, but when you think about every cool show, the best, coolest parts come out of when something went wrong.
Right.
You know, when somebody had a secret and failed to keep it. Battlestar Galactica is one of my favorites for that kind of thing. Tremendous amounts of drama coming off of the worst possible thing that you would never want anybody to find out, finding out.
And that's what I'm trying to get at, is that you don't have to have this completely story-driven thing where failure means I go and talk to somebody else instead. It can literally mean failure in this particular action scene leads to an even cooler action scene.
Right, or a more complicated action scene. Yeah, throw a penalty on them. Fine, great. You know, it's like, hey, we were doing a chase along a cliff, and you blew that dexterity check. Roll the dice to see whether or not we're going to continue the chase scene on the cliff, or if we're going to continue this down in the river about 100 yards below.
Sure.
Everyone's like, oh, dude, you know,
yeah.
That's going to be cool. They're already planning, like, what they're going to do with the branches on the way down.
Yeah, and again, that's when they're like, oh, well, failure would be cooler because, man, we get to go down there and have the big thing down there as opposed to just rolling down the roll.
One of my favorite GMs to work with, one of my favorite guys to talk with about this kind of thing, who plays, runs a lot of HeroQuest, which in many ways is a very traditional fantasy game, loves to come up with consequences that make you wish you could fail. D&D is a whiff-tastic game. Wouldn't it be cool if 50% of the time you got what you want and the other 50% of the time things got more awesome?
How can you have it be more awesome instead of be a punishment? Because that's typically how D&D has been set up. Well, if you don't defeat these four guards, 100 guards are going to come out.
A combat scene against 15 kobolds is kind of boring. A combat scene where your goal is, I'm being chased by these four giants behind me because I just stole their magical whatchamajigger, and I've got to get through this room with 15 kobolds who are trying to kill me, is a very different situation because failure to beat them does not mean that
you've failed to succeed in what you're trying to do.
You've changed the framework. It's not about killing them and beating every single one of them into a bloody pulp over the course of 10 interminable combat rounds. It's, can I move and kill very specific ones or whatever I'm going to do so I can get across this room in 3 rounds, which is what the goal is.
Right.
If I don't do that, things get more interesting because now it's kobolds and there's giants.
You know? That really is the GM's job then, to frame the scene as your goal is to get through this room.
Or this is going to happen.
Or this is going to happen, as opposed to you walk into a room and there's 15 kobolds.
Yeah.
At which point the players then get to frame the thing saying, we're going to take on the kobold.
I think this is kind of key, especially with the combat system, because of the way it works and because people are so traditionally used to that idea that you're going to play and you're going to run this combat. And if you fail enough, you're going to die.
Right.
You need to be unafraid of framing that up immediately at the beginning, because otherwise, geez, everyone's losing. So the giants come up and grab you and the kobolds and toss you in the jail cell. That feels like a GM cop out. If you tell them right up front, here's the deal. You have to get through this room in X number of rounds, blah, blah, blah. Go after this, take out the kobolds, or the giants are going to come in and grab all y'all. Then they know. And they know that's not the GM copping out. That's the consequences. And again, right. It's almost like, man, couldn't we fail? Wouldn't it be kind of cool? Oh, you know, it'd be even better is some of us got through in three rounds and some of us didn't, you know?
The nice thing about D&D is that there is a default stakes in every scene, which is we're going to fight you and we're either going to live or die.
Yeah.
And that's nice because it makes it so you don't have to worry about the stakes. Yeah,
it's sort of stated.
At the same time,
combat's the trickiest one because of that. But
At the same time, it can kind of become a crutch in that every scene is, well, we're going to take them on and we're going to live or we're going to die. And so framing up different sorts of consequences is actually sort of a foreign thing to D&D that's harder to bring in.
Honestly, you could take the entire combat system out of D&D and just use the skill check thing. Use that system for all the combat and you basically have an indie game with a slightly busted resolution mechanic. What is the one thing that D&D, especially 4.0, does so well? It's miniatures-driven, tactical-based combat.
Right.
Why would you take that out and still play that game? What is it doing for you at that point in time? Nothing. I mean, nothing that any other game couldn't do. Maybe that's not the part of the game that you need to have that change between death or not. The point of those combats is supposed to be that tactical stuff, and it is a win or lose kind of thing. You know, set up some interesting consequences for being caught, captured, more people get added to the mix, whatever. Let it be that live or die kind of thing.
Because that's what D&D is good at. At the same time, your combat doesn't have to be to the death. And it's your job as the DM to offer that to your group, to say, okay, so the giants have come in. It's clear to your characters there's no way you're going to fight them.
Yeah.
So now this is diplomacy. And you don't really give them an option. So you're going to be negotiating while you're defending yourself against the rest of these people who can care less.
Oh, that even makes it better. Yeah. I like that.
So when it comes to D&D, it's probably one of the games that requires more preparation in terms of the mechanics of the system than a typical story game. Do you think that is a hindrance to incorporating story type stuff into it because you have to have so much of the math figured out ahead of time?
To a certain extent, I almost think it makes it easier. Having that player input makes it easier because honestly, coming up with ideas is hard. Going to that well, having those players there that can give you a contribution. Maybe it's just sitting around kibitzing after the game is over. There's an old gaming story about that. The GM used to give one of his players contribution points for sitting around the kitchen table on a Saturday night, the day after the game, sitting around drinking beer. And the guy would just sit there and talk about what he thought was going on in the campaign.
Oh, right. Which gives you, of course, many awesome
ideas. And the GM
would
just sit there and go, really? Is that what you think? You know, and throw out 90% of it, but use that stuff. So to a certain extent, having the player contribution does make it a little bit easier. 4.0 is easily far and above
faster prep
for that kind of thing. And it is possible, completely possible, to say, okay, well, you guys are being attacked by a water elemental, so I'm going to grab the ochre jelly and say that the acid damage is actually drawing damage. Go
right. And I think that's beautiful that they encourage you to do that everywhere in the system, to say, if you don't have a monster that is exactly what you want, then just take this one, use its numbers, but describe it differently.
Yeah.
You know, once Wizards gets their databases and all that stuff online, I think that this will be much less of an issue.
My little heart will grow 3 sizes when that happens.
Yeah.
I swear. I mean, that will be really, really useful.
I'm trying not to be cynical and instead be hopeful and encouraging. So let's go ahead and talk about if you were going to actually add rules to D&D to incorporate some of these indie type things, what would they be?
Tim, you're personally familiar with one of the main hacks that I do right now. Which has to do with action points. From a strictly action point of view, I really like the idea of characters being able to push. And there's really no mechanic for that necessarily certainly not before 4. There's no currency that the player has to be able to say, no, I'm trying really, really hard. I'm going to push. I'm going to use up some resources.
Really important to me. The only thing they've ever really had is, I'm going to use the potion for this, or I'll go ahead and use a charge on my wand.
Exactly.
This,
when I saw what they'd done in 4.0 with action points, I expanded that a very little bit. The first thing I did was, not only does it let you take an extra action, if you want to, you can instead use it to reroll. Because sometimes people are like blowing their daily power and they blow it. To say, well, if you want to, you can spend an action point and just make a basic attack. You already blew your daily. That was going to be your big game changer.
Right.
Let me reroll that.
And you know, the dice are so important in 4E. I have never seen an encounter go bad as fast with rolling
with the dice.
Until
so,
4E.
You know, that was really minor hack. Let them reroll. The other thing that I did, because I felt like action points are a little bit too rare, was I wanted to make them more common. I wanted to touch as little as possible in the game. So what I was doing was having people trade in healing surges directly for action points. So if they wanted to, they could burn up a healing surge to get another action point. Just using it for those two things, the idea being that it's going to tap into their healing surges, so it's going to hurt their longevity, but they're going to get to be awesome when they want to be awesome. I still had limits in place where you couldn't spend more action points than just the one per round.
Yeah, you're so not going to be able to blow all your healing surges knowing that you're about to go to bed anyway.
You could theoretically keep dropping them like every round. What I ran into there was that was a little bit too much. You know, so there's a dial. That was kind of turned to 11. I wanted to bring it back. And then the other thing I wanted to add on to that was that what they've done in Spirit of the Century with fate points, where if I want to, I can drop that point and say something. You guys are in this really cool fight scene. I'm supposed to be across town. I'm going to spend an action point and I run in with a hoagie in one hand and a mug of beer going, hey guys, what's up? I don't care, but you know, I want to be able to do that. And I've been playing with that, but I haven't really gotten to the point where I was really happy with what the currency exchange was on the action points.
Well, the other thing that's nice about Spirit of the Century in terms of that is that you get this sort of temptation maneuver.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll give you an action point if you give me something, you know, from the story.
If you screw yourself here, you'll get more fate points to be awesome later. One of the games that I really, really love is The Shadow of Yesterday, which is by Clinton Nixon. Go back to this idea that the system doesn't recognize when you're doing something character significant. We haven't really touched on the games that do that. And Shadow of Yesterday is definitely one of those games that does do that. It's got a mechanic in place called keys. Every character has a number of keys between like 1 and 5.
Right. And if you do something related to your key,
it gives you experience points. And that's the only way that you can get experience points. So I might have the key of Guardian. Your character has a ward that you take care of. This is a classic champions thing, right? You've got your dependent NPC. But in this case, the person's with you. They only generate points for you in play in the game. If that person is in the scene, you get a point. If they're in the scene and it changes the decision that you would otherwise make in the scene because of their presence, then you get a few more points.
And if
you have to put
yourself
at serious risk to keep them out of danger, then you get more points. And that's how those keys are defined. I had originally played around with the D&D system of just junking the whole XP system and putting that key system in place. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of goofy because what really happens at that point in time is your character gets better. Great, you get experience points, you level up. So by role playing and really being into this, my character gets better at killing stuff.
Yeah, they don't match. It really needs to be two parallel tracks.
Right. Actually, when I was prepping to do this podcast, was thinking about this and saying, okay, well, let's do this with keys. Let's have a couple of keys for your characters. When you hit that key, when that key becomes relevant, let's say you've got that guardian key.
Oh, you can get a fate point.
You get your action point.
Yeah.
It's completely divorced from the whole healing surge thing.
Nice.
And it's a small number. If the person's involved in the scene, you get an action point. If the person changes what your decision would be, you get two. If you have to put yourself at serious risk, like fighting 5 guards when you really can't take 5 guards so that they can escape, mm-hmm. you can get like 3. That could give you a lot. You're still limiting how many you can do per round. And again, you're not going to want to keep putting yourself at tremendous risk. Going back to this thing with combat with D&D, it's not exactly healthy.
Right. You know, if you've got to sacrifice yourself to protect this other person just to get a fate point, you still could end up dead.
And the thing that's really cool about that is that the system recognizes what you're doing with your character.
Yeah.
Now, you can have somebody who's a guardian, who's got their ward. Can you do that in D&D? Absolutely. Can you throw yourself in harm's way to protect that person? Absolutely. Does the system care?
Does it
acknowledge it? No, there's no reward for that.
Yeah.
It
literally becomes diceless again.
The GM might reward you and say, man, that was really cool. See, I'm gonna give you some extra XP. But that's not the system that we're using at the table. It's in the books, recognizing it. So doing this lets the system do this. One of the other things that's very cool about this is the sort of the buy-off mechanic. I call it the cash-in mechanic on this, is that when you act against that key, you have the option at that point. So I'm saying, yeah, I'm cashing it in.
I've given up on that part of my character.
Yeah, this is a game-changing moment. You choose not to throw yourself in harm's way to keep that person safe. And now maybe that's because something else is happening. You're like, no, I'm actually going to continue to be a guardian. It's just this one particular situation. So you just don't get rewarded. You don't get penalized for it. You don't get rewarded for it. It just happened. But you can choose to say, no, I'm not protecting this person anymore. I'm done being a guardian. You can never take that key again. And you get like 10 action points.
Right. Yeah. Because, this is a big game changer.
Yeah.
Thing.
It's like, whoa. And you think about this in television, where that was the moment where so and so went bad. That was the moment where they gave up caring about their wife. That was the moment where they gave up hope that they would ever reform the FBI. You know, when that happens, a big gong goes off. The game responds and does that. This lets you have a currency for input. Got this action point. I can spend it and say, you're not really asking for my input here, but I would like it. So I'm going to give you an action point if you would just let me say X is happening right now. You know,
you get that temptation.
I would like there to be a storm. I'm going to use this thing up, and I'm holding my finger out here like I'm holding a poker chip.
Yeah.
And I'm going to throw in. The other part of it is tie that system in. So the system is another thing, another person sitting at the table saying, dude, that was awesome. Let me give you some points for that.
Yeah, very much so. That draws a wider variety of players into it because there's certain players who are like, well, you know, I'll talk about it. I go and visit my mom and that's it. But if the system then gives them some rewards for that, then they might take that extra step of saying, I'm going to invest more than just 2 minutes of role playing.
Some people will look at the thing and see, so the game is basically forcing you to do this. I'm like, no, it's not. You don't have to do it. Are you going to do it anyway in D&D? Sure. If you got a big clear picture of what your character is going to do, and you do that, you're going to do it anyway. And if you just suddenly decide that your character's giving up on this person, yeah, it's going to be kind of significant. And maybe everybody else at the table will come to you afterwards and say, man, that was really cool. But wouldn't it be great if the game did it too?
What I like about it being a parallel mechanic instead of being XP is that I can't tell you how many games I've been in where the DM will give you XP if you keep track of initiative. The DM will give you XP if you write a background story.
I don't really love metagame like rewards for
stuff. Or the DM will give you XP if you do something particularly cool in the game.
It's cool to them. And again, at that point in time, you're just gaming the system of doing the cool thing that the GM thinks is cool.
Right, and that's you what I didn't like sucks. About the hero points in Star Wars either, is that, well, if your players do something particularly heroic, you can give them a hero point. Well, who defines that, and what does that mean to a character who's kind of an anti-hero, and what does that mean?
Yeah, you know, plus they're so insanely rare that, you know, nobody ever then wants to spend them. You know,
yeah.
I mean, to a certain extent, I do want there to be more action points that are, because I want people to use them for more things. I don't just want there to be the do another action. I want there to be the reroll. And I also want there to be that, you know, I want to narrate that. I want to be able to say this is happening. I want a jalopy to show up right now.
And since it's parallel, and it's literally, this is the stuff that you can do. You get rewarded for doing stuff in the story, and you can use it to affect the story. Mm-hmm. You can also maybe use it to affect a little bit of stuff in combat, but it's not as good as like a plus one sword or something would be. Then it also allows you to not completely screw up the power mechanics of the game by giving people extra XP.
Right.
Because if you reward people with XP, then person X goes up faster than person Y, and you have to keep track of all that.
If people have a bunch of extra action points, yeah, fine, great, whatever. You can burn them on more things, and you can be awesome for an extended period of time, whatever, but you're still constrained on how many you can use around. There's two key parts to this, and there's also, and I sent you links to this, there's a place where people came up with sort of D&D-like keys. I put links to that, and here's the paladin key. Here's the key that, he didn't call it that, but here's the key that paladins would want to have. And
yeah, well, whenever you talk about keys, I always think about paladins and alignment and losing your paladinhood and all that kind of stuff.
The big thing you need to do with the keys is make it the player's responsibility to chime in when those things get hit. The players are awarding themselves the action points. If you want to double check, fine, but eventually you should be in a group that you're enjoying playing with and that you trust to say, okay, he knows as well as anyone that he was thrown in harm's way because he was protecting this other person. Write it down, dude. Don't stop me. I'm busy doing this other thing. I got enough stuff to do.
And if the DM has to sign off and everything, then it becomes a negotiation, and then it's all back to DM fiat again.
Exactly, which we don't want to do. And you get to decide. Be in that group. That's all I can say, is be in that group that you can trust those people. Because if you're not, if you don't trust the people that you're playing with to like play fair with that kind of stuff, then why are you playing with them?
That's part of the nice thing about being parallel, is that even if somebody is a little loosey-goosey with their definition of what hit a key, they can only spend things so quickly, so it's not going to completely unbalance the game like XP.
Let them get a huge stockpile. You can talk to them about it after the game and say, dude, seriously, I really don't think that going in and failing a couple of drunk rolls counts as being put in serious danger to protect your guardian. Talk about it after the game. I'm still leaving it up to you, but I'd like you to dial it back a little bit. One other quick hack I'm going to throw out there is from Conspiracy of Shadows that Keith Sankowski came up with. He's got a thing in there called Doom. Completely different mechanic, something else you can bolt on. I love this game because it's basically a bunch of bolt-on parts that he bolted together, and you could bolt off and put on other things. This would be for a much darker game, but one of the things you do during character generation is come up with your character's doom, and at any point during the game when you're in a conflict, you can invoke your character's doom to basically just win the conflict. Done. No dice are rolled. You narrate how it goes down, and it foreshadows your doom. Okay? And you can do that six times. On the sixth time, you win.
The doom happens.
And the doom is going to be the next scene that you do with that character. So for those dark, gritty Warhammer games or the doomed Street Samurai Shadowrun games, this stuff bolts on really well. A guy had never heard of the system before, anything like that. He sat there and he could not think of anything. What he finally came up with, which was just awesome, was I will die within inches of my goal.
Right.
The thing is, if you never invoke your doom to just win,
then you're never going to get
anywhere. You have complete control over whether or not that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because you can just say, you know, I'm going to let the dice fall where they may. And if I lose, I lose. If I win, I win. But I want this to happen. And not only that, but I want to win, but I want it to be a little bit ominous. Yeah, we'll invoke that. You see people who will drive themselves through to their doom in one game session, and other people who never touch it.
I think that would be helpful, though, if you sort of had a feel as a player for how many sessions you were going to go and got a feel for the pace of it. Because you don't want to crank up the doom factor if there's going to be another 20 sessions left to go.
There's so many times where I've fallen down in terms of communication with my players that for your D&D game, I had a player playing big, strong, incredibly strong fighter. wisdom in the tank, spent probably the entire time that he played that character accumulating gear and whatnot that would cover up the gaping holes that he had in that character. So he got his, his charisma up to, 12 or 13. It's like half ogre. He's got a charisma
he gets
up to like
a band of intelligence or whatever. And
he told me at one point, I thought it was just going to be a dungeon crawl kind of thing, but we were doing all this story stuff. And if I'd have known at the time how long this was going to go and how far it was going to go and how deep it was going to go, I would have had a different character.
Yeah.
At the end, his character was one of my favorites. It was a painful transition to get him to the point where he ended up being like, I don't want to call him a general because his whole goal was to literally destabilize the entire region. Like he wanted anarchy. So right. he became Fidel Castro. He had a group of soldiers under him that he was controlling, but his purpose was to dethrone everybody and put no one in their place. The world is a mess and I just want to rule it. No, it wasn't even that.
The current world is bad. I don't have anything better, but I know this thing.
If I completely reset it, something more interesting will at least be happening and I'll have more people to kill.
So let's talk a minute about structure versus no structure. A game like PTA has been criticized for the only structure is you're going to have a TV show. Everything else has to be sort of invented by whole cloth from the players, which really puts a lot of pressure on the players to invent that stuff. Whereas a game like Dogs in the Vineyard says you're going to make a character who has these characteristics and this equipment.
And this is what you're doing. Your goal is to do this, protecting them, judging them, that sort of thing. And it's a very structured thing. First of all, you don't have to play PTA that way. That's the way Primetime Adventures is like written up for. But there's no reason. Jason Morningstar actually mentioned this not too long ago. They call it the Jason game when they do PTA Jason style, which is he comes with the concept, with the basic concept.
Oh, okay.
So he comes with, we're going to do the Civil War game, but with superheroes. Maybe that's all he gives them. And they still do a lot of the building themselves, but he gives them some structure.
Well, and I think it really depends on the group because, some of the people to whom I've introduced Galactic really embrace the story elements that he puts in there and says, oh, I really like this idea that there's Caliban and then there's this Church of Isabel and all that. And other people, I love the mechanics of it. I love the way it works. And I'm going to throw out every piece of the story stuff that comes with the game. And I want to invent all the rest of it from whole cloth.
This is one of the things that actually got the author of that game kind of discouraged is that one of the main responses that he keeps getting from some game people that have done playtests on this is that playing your game made me want to write my own sci-fi game.
Right.
He gets discouraged about it. I'm like, dude, think about how many people you're inspiring.
Yeah.
Your game is now maybe he feels like the inspiration is for frustration. For me, it's not. The inspiration is entirely from this is awesome.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people to whom I've introduced Dogs in the Vineyard don't like it because of the deep religious nature of the setting.
Sure.
And I'm like, well, you're missing the fact that there's all this cool conflict mechanic and all this kind of stuff going on. You're getting mired in that setting. So sometimes
I know some people get very hung up on that. It's like, let's play the Jedis. Let's just play it as Jedis or something like that.
Yeah, and so that's one of the things that's sort of fascinating about indie games is that they try so hard not to be generic. They're really trying to focus on, I want to get this sort of feel across.
Exactly.
That they kind of get discouraged or don't like it when you sort of rip the mechanics out and try to make it a more generic thing.
They're smaller, I think, to a certain extent. They are smaller games, both in audience and in size of the book even. Because of the fact that they're much more focused and you're going to have a smaller audience because since it is so focused, you're going to have people that concept just turns off.
Right.
I love Dogs in the Vineyard. I have come to accept the fact that there's going to be some people who just are never going to want to play that game. I came off of reading The Dark Tower and I looked at that thing and said, oh, it's paladins with six guns. And I was hooked. Other people looked at it and said, okay, this is a fantasy retelling of The Settling of Utah. And we're not immediately enamored of that concept, which I didn't even see. I literally had to be told that there was a parallel there.
Yeah, and what's interesting is because Vincent does such a good job of storytelling within the rules, that's probably one of the most delightful rule books to read of any I've ever read.
Vincent writes differently. He doesn't write a rules book as much as he has a conversation with you in which he explains the rules.
Yes.
So you do need to reread those rules a lot because Vincent tells you everything to play the game, and then you go and play it, and you come back to him and you talk to him again. Let me explain that part again, because I don't feel like you really got it. And so you do do some rereading of those rules because it is like a conversation. Whereas with D&D, it's a, what's that recurring joke in Beetlejuice? These read like stereo instructions.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where you're at with a lot of those encyclopedic rules things. And everybody's a little bit different. Primetime Adventures is written a little bit differently. Sometimes more conversationally, sometimes tone's uneven. It's very conversational and then becomes very formal. I just had a conversation with Matt about that. He's going through and revising Primetime Adventures now. And he's like, man, I can't believe some of the stuff I wrote. Who was I trying to impress? Seriously, was I trying to get a girlfriend? Because what the hell was I writing? Why was I writing it like that? But yeah, that focus there, it will turn off some people.
And that's why I think it's so interesting to take a look at the scene as a whole and to take a look at individual things you like in these games and not be afraid to bolt them on in other places, because sometimes you may not want to sit down and play Paladins in the Old West. You just want to have a really cool verbal exchange mechanic.
I mean, I've had people don't love the mechanic, and that's fine too. They're wrong. They're incredibly, incredibly wrong, but no.
You know, it's interesting because I've played it with some people who just, that is completely natural for them, and they do it without even metagaming at all.
Yeah.
We'll just push the dice around and everything else, and
some people
never
feel like
discuss.
The dice are very intrusive into their role.
Yeah, and other people sit there and stare at their dice pool because there has to be a right way to do it. I can imagine certain people that we know sitting there doing
that. Oh, yeah. And honestly, the first time I ran Dogs in the Vineyard was about 4 years ago. The players felt like the dice were so in the way. We had to think so much about the dice that they were in the way. Then we went back and we played a bunch of under indie games and the time we came back to run Dogs in the Vineyard, and it was so natural because we'd gotten used to the idea of that is another element that's contributing to the story. The dice can be in there contributing to the story.
Right.
And it's okay.
It's beautiful when the dice push you in the way that you don't want to go, and you have to deal with that, and the consequence isn't death.
I'm a complete Buffy fan, Buffy freak, Joss Whedon fan, but one of my favorite story tweaks that happened in one of the seasons of Buffy was when Oz had to leave. Just came out of nowhere with all the werewolf thing, and then he decided, I can't be around you guys, I'm not safe, and I left. It was very cool. It was completely unintended, and they didn't know it was going to happen 2 weeks ahead of time because Seth Green got a job for a movie, and it was basically, come here and film this, or we can't have you on the film.
Yes.
He had to go. Because of that, they basically had to go, oh, geez, okay, and use him before he had to be gone. And it ended up being really fun, really cool.
And then when he came back later, there was a lot more drama.
Yeah, it was a lot more drama. And the thing is, sometimes the dice are going to do something that you don't want. That pushes you to another level. It pushes your creativity, I think, a little bit to have that level of constraint. It's not completely constrained, but you got to have that level of constraint that says, okay, I just did a great speech. I'm doing all this stuff. I'm including all this stuff. I want to bring all these other little elements of my character into play. I'm going to pull out my gun and my coat's doing those amazing stuff.
And I roll
and
five
I get all this dice and I roll absolute crap. And I had absolute crap before, and so I've got nothing. So I did an amazing speech. Nobody's going to deny that. I'm sitting there doing it. Everyone knows it was awesome.
But no one cared.
But the guy that you're doing to, it falls on complete deaf ears. And that can be okay. Now we know so much more, not just about your character, but about that NPC, because that amazing thing had absolutely no effect on him. Has he no soul?
And I love rolling with the dice, and I do this with Galactic too, is to say, okay, the dice are telling me this. How can I tell a story that goes along with what the dice are saying without completely screwing everything up? So I say, the guy who you just gave the speech to says, you know, you talk pretty, and you ain't say nothing I don't believe, but I'm still going to shoot you.
Yeah. The thing is, you're sitting at a table with four or five other players. They're all doing exactly the same thing. Why can't the system do it too? You know, let the system be a player. Let the system have its input into. Otherwise, why are you using a system at all? We can freeform. Lots of people do very successfully and have a great time. I mean, I played City of Heroes online MMO for 3 years and had some fantastic, great role-playing sessions in there and some great stories come out of it. Stuff that I wrote pages and pages and pages of stuff about beforehand, afterwards. Had a great time. Never a dice. The system in that game is meant to blow up bad guys. I mean, it's powers and that's it. There's no support for it in the game, and you don't have any authority as the player to do something with a dice roll. There's no mechanical support whatsoever for the role play. You can do that.
And that's
why
people,
if you have a system, use the system. Let the system have a voice at the table.
Well, and what I've often found, you know, with like MUDs back in the day, which were totally ruleless, right? I mean, or MUSH at least.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, I'm going to talk and you're going to talk and we're going to do this. And we have this side channel where we're sort of meta talking about what's going on.
Yeah.
And then there's the main channel where the dialogue's happening.
Yep.
No rules are required. You just do whatever you want to do. The problem is that it works great as long as you have continual influx of new people to give you new ideas.
Yeah.
But when you have the same group of people, which is typical for a gaming group, you got the same five or six people. At some point,
the
well runs dry. You got to get some spice in there, and the dice can often help you with that if you'll let them.
I think that may also be one of the reasons why indie games tend to run short and are healthy for running short. To bring it all the way back around to the beginning, you've got this character that you're exploring. You do that arc. You get a certain sense of closure. Now we're going to go do something completely different and play Inspectors. First samurai in a bloodbath of revenge and betrayal. Now Ghostbusters.
Right.
Why do we do that? Because we're still playing with the same players. We've hit that well a lot. Let's go to a completely different well.
Yeah.
Let's take a completely different creative
your
energy.
Ideas and
absolutely. You need to switch because, like you said, everybody's got to come with a game. I mean, they've got to be willing to contribute. you can tire people out. So it's kind of nice to have that game end and go on. Imagine 4.5 years of that level of contribution with the same characters.
Yeah. Well, this is what I loved about classic events at the convention was you could have characters that had serious issues.
Yeah.
And there was lots of things at stake between them. And at the start of the game, there was stuff that was broken and it was ready to explode. It explodes in the middle and there's aftermath and the game's done.
Yep.
Whereas if you did that in a weekly campaign, that all happens, and then what do you do next week?
Yep.
And that's really tough.
To a certain extent, I kind of roll my eyes at the indie games because somebody will say, you know what I want to do? I want to do a game that's like Tarantino-esque. I want to do like a bank heist and the betrayal thing at the end and the reveal and so on and so forth. And so I'm writing a game for that. And I'm like, you know, you could just write a module. There's very few people in the indie world. I can think of one example of a scenario, a module, published
Burning
module.
Burning Wheel does it, but Burning Wheel does it.
And somebody wrote one for HeroQuest that's actually very good that I've used actually twice to great effect. And basically all it is a situation. Here's all the NPCs.
Yep.
And here's the instructions for tying your PCs into the situation. Go. And it can be like that. There are 100 systems you could do a bank heist with. Bolt on a couple things. Couldn't you just write the scenario and not write a whole bloody new game that I have to teach?
Of course, the big deal with the Fantasy Heartbreakers, right, is that
yeah.
if we're just going to play D&D, just play D&D.
Yeah.
If you want to have different monsters or different something like that, and I think that's what D20 did really well, is to say, if all you really want to do is add 10 new monsters to D&D, here you
write
go.
Write a module.
Yeah, write we'll a module and have fun, and you can publish it, and everybody's happy. If what you want to do is explore a new kind of mechanic, which I think Dogs in the Vineyard does really well, I think Mountain Witch, Polaris,
mechanics. You couldn't really do a Polaris story with D&D. You couldn't, I don't think, as easily do the mechanics of Dogs in the Vineyard with D&D. There's types of fantasy games that are better done even with other fantasy games. HeroQuest is one of my favorite fantasy games. And you could run the same kind of game, but it has a very different emphasis in those two different games. And that's fine, too. And we'll go back to Galactic. We use a lot of references to a game that doesn't actually isn't out there for people to go and play. So we kind of suck. But with Galactic, you've got this whole setup where everybody's playing their own captain and everybody else makes up crew for each other's captains you're training around. That would be a nightmare in a lot of traditional games. You need something different for that. To do that kind of game. And it ends up being awesome. You know, I love that game.
And you know, I love it too. And what I like about it is that the dice are the group. It's the group's dice.
Yes.
That everybody contributes to.
Yeah.
And not my dice versus your dice versus Bob's dice.
It really feels like a ship's crew working together because everybody's dice are out there in that same pool going against the enemy.
And you could tell 100 different kinds of stories with a group aimed that way. Whereas, again, the D&D concept isn't really we're a group. It's, you know, we're a loosely confederated, pile of
I think it's very interesting because Matt Wilson, who wrote Primetime Adventures, is also the guy who wrote Galactica. You could essentially run any story using Primetime Adventures, and it would work. It's all going to be about the character issues, but you could run a fantasy game using Primetime Adventures. Galactic is almost the polar opposite of that because it's meant to run a captain with a crew. It doesn't really port very well to anything else, except for maybe like pirates.
Pirates is the first thing
that
comes.
But again, it's a captain with a crew. You can't like run a D&D game,
you know, the setting that actually I thought the other day, if I was to run a Buffy the Vampire Slayer game, that would be absolutely perfect. Because each... Instead of a
Everyone
captain,
listen
you have
to
a
him.
Slayer.
Tim's wise.
And then you've got the Scoobies.
Yeah.
You know, you've got their Slayer and your Scoobies. And again, there's so many shows that are, here's some character who's better than normal and their associates.
Yeah. As soon as we get done finishing up Galactic and I finish editing the game for Matt and we get it out, I'm immediately going to do the Supergirl and Sidekicks variant rules and release them for free on the internet.
Even if you wanted to do something weirdly more traditional, like the A-Team, although each of those guys had a lot more skills than your Galactic crew do.
You have everybody done up as a full level character, but also they have a version of themselves that's just as a crew member and everybody takes turns being the captain from week to week.
If you wanted to do something really wacky like the Ghost Whisperer, she's the one that's got the powers. Everybody else is just kind of a hanger-on.
That's true, yeah.
You know, there's so many shows and stories where you've got one exceptional person and the people around them.
The flip side to that is, with Galactic, is you've got...
Multiple
examples of that. None of the stuff that the indie games really do is something that has never happened before in D&D. The scenes, the situations, thematic play, a storyline with a message... That stuff's all happened.
Dicelessly.
Diceless stuff. That stuff's all happened in the game, but it's not the game's fault, and it's not to the game's credit that any of that stuff happened. So a lot of what you see in these indie games are games that are setting out to say, let me help you with this. Let me be on your side. Let me be somebody else at the table who's saying, oh, you want to do this story? To really get into somebody's guts about what they're afraid of, what they're excited about, what they love, what they hate. Here's a game that does that. This game's actually going to react to that.
So there's nothing stopping you from bolting this on in D&D.
Absolutely not.
And there's nothing that D&D is going to hamper you from doing this.
Partly because there's nothing there in the areas that you're going to expand. It's an unfinished basement. You can put whatever you want to down in there.
So you can really take a lot of these bits and pieces from these indie games, whether they be mechanic type things or just techniques like we discussed before, and add them to your game to help you with the role playing.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily here to make this into a crazy pass the stick game.
Yeah.
They're here to say, you're enjoying the tactical part and the game helps you with that by giving you options in combat. And what this is going to do is help you with the role playing part of it by giving you options for that.
The one thing I'll say about hacking stuff on the D&D is be aware of that line that you pass. And it's maybe kind of a hazy line where all the stuff that you've thrown onto the game makes it not D&D anymore. You've taken out so much or added so much that you're essentially playing a different game.
Well, Doyce, thanks for joining us here, and we'll look forward to seeing how all this stuff works into Northmoor in the future, as well as other things.
Thank you. This was a ton of fun.
So that was our interview with Doyce Testerman. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have any questions or comments, please join us at our forums at spookyouthouse.com. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Return to Northmoor, a podcast released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 2.5 license by Tim White and Kim Stone. Our theme music is Charge of the Valiant from Dronolin's Tower, Legends of Kithelin Volume 1, Tales of the Long Forgotten, used by permission of its composer, David Alan Young. Find out more about their fantastic gaming music at dronolin.com. Visit us and many other fine podcasts at spookyouthouse.com.